everybody. Welcome back to the Ones Ready podcast. You're in the team room, and we have Colonel Vice Fallon. Appreciate you joining us.
You bet, Peaches. Thanks, brother.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a long time since we chatted like 20 minutes ago. But yep. No, thanks for having me on here. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, first I'd like to start off and just say, you know, thanks to you, Aaron and Trent, for the stuff that you guys do, you know, not only for our airmen and AFSPEC war and pushing the Air Force message, but, you know, for all those folks out there that are your subs that are thinking about joining, wanting to join, know people to join, man, I just think that's huge. Like, you guys have done things and have a reach that most of us can only dream about.
So, well, appreciate it.
Yeah. It's, good. It's good to be a part of that.
No, well, thanks again. Yeah. Thanks for joining. Yeah. So you, and I don't want to get you any kind of trouble or anything like that, but I don't even know whether I should call you a Viper guy or, ooh, that's tough.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely a Panther driver now. So you gotta, you know, a long time ago, someone told me that the squadron that flies you, the squadron that supplies you with bullets, that's your home, right? So,
okay.
So right now it's F-35. Background, started off in the Air Force after the Air Force Academy as an F-16 pilot. Did that for about 18 years, about 2,500 hours, 600 plus hours in combat, all GWAT. and then about 6 months ago, transitioned to the F-35. So I stepped into this role here in Nellis. It's been great. So it's cool to see both platforms. The last time I was here at the weapons school as an instructor, the F-35 was just, you know, coming online into our Air Force, but we were just standing up a weapons school here. And so being able to kind of see that full circle and come back and get to be a part of that has been fantastic. And, you know, for dudes like you and me, as we get, say, more mature and more learned, any opportunity you can get to reconnect back to those tactical roots, man, those are precious. Mm-hmm. They're few and far between. And so every opportunity you get, you know, you definitely got to take advantage of those. And those are ones that that you think about for a while. So it's been good. You know, I couldn't ask for more when you look back on career and opportunities. I know you guys all feel the same way. And, you know, talking to folks that are thinking about taking a career path into the Air Force, I mean, that's for all of us old dudes that look at it. You're like, man, that absolutely, I would do it again, because it's just the adventure and the opportunities. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's unmatched. No matter where you are in life, you're going to get those, you're going to get that adventure. You're going to get those opportunities. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, working on a farm in Iowa or a big city in New York, you join the Air Force and you are going to get adventure and you're going to get service.
Oh, for sure. So yeah.
It's fantastic.
I mean, did you always know that you wanted to fly?
Absolutely not.
No?
No. So I grew up in high school. A couple things I thought maybe I wanted to do, but went to high school in St. Louis, was decent at football, and got picked up by the Air Force Academy to play football there. Even once I got to the Air Force Academy, wasn't like, ooh, I want to go fly planes. Thought about cross commissioning, thought about doing some different things. And then eventually my senior year, finally, which is a weird part of the Air Force Academy, but you don't have a lot of interaction with pilots, especially fighter pilots. And so my senior year, I finally had a class with someone who was a cargo pilot, and just talking about kind of the flying lifestyle. And said, hey, did you ever think about being like a fighter pilot? Seemed like a young, kind of aggressive dude, might be a good fit for you. And that was the first time. Like, it was just that interaction. I go, yeah, I'll just do that.
It's that easy.
That's right. So I said, I'll do that. And you know, the cool thing about it, and not everyone's like this, but I would say it's about a 50-50 cut, is that, you know, you asked me, started right off with platforms. The Air Force were very platform centric. For me, I look back at it now, and maybe it wasn't always the same, but, man, I could have driven tanks for a living. I could have driven a ship for a living. Like, it's not the platform, it's the teamwork. And the beauty of fighter aviation is, you know, much like small teams that you've been on, although completely different and different skill sets. So you get a small elite team, 4 to 8 to maybe 12 aircraft all operating at a very extreme and a very high-end level of performance, elite performance, to be able to execute a mission. And it's really that. It's that teamwork. It's all, I mean, when it's good and it's going right, it's that exact same feeling you had in high school sports. It's the same. And so I think those are key things for me, beyond just like the stick and rudder and, oh, it must be fun to fly. Like, I don't fly as a civilian. Probably when I hang up the cleats in the Air Force, I'll probably never touch a plane again. Like, unless I got to go fly for UPS, you know, like.
You got to make ends meet.
Yeah, and you got to put food on the table or something like that. Yeah, short of that. So aviation is cool and fighter aviation is awesome, but I think of it more from an employment aspect. It's like when dudes ask me what's it like to fly, and not you, obviously, because you know the game. But when people ask me that, your general population, GPOP, the first thought that goes in my mind, what they want is like, oh, it's fun, and you get to like fly low and bank, and there's pull G's, and it's, and like, they want to hear all that stuff. But the first thing that flashes through my mind is combat. The first thing that flashes through my mind is hitting TOTs with bombs as dudes kick down doors and you're picking off squirters and strafing in the middle of the night. That's the first thing that pops through my mind. It's not the flying. It's not that sort of stuff. It's the actual, you know, operational end, the business end of what actually gets accomplished and getting the mission done. So,
yeah, well, I mean, that's that magical kind of feeling you're talking about with small teams in combat. Everybody is operating at a certain level and everything's just right. I mean, there's some shit happening on the ground for sure, right? And maybe us on the ground would disagree with like, hey, everything's going right. But at the same time, we're, you know, the assault force commander is talking to the JTAC and the assault force sergeant major, and we are synced up. They trust me implicitly. I trust them. And now I'm talking to you, and we have a stack overhead, and we've already sectored all the squirters. We've got all the plans doped out, and it's game time, and it just feels good.
Yeah, it's weird, and you know, people have described it as like flow state. You know, that gets talked about a lot, which is great. I think that's a very useful paradigm, and love where that's going through our community now. It's also, you know, and this is just another take on it, it also sometimes just feels like you're watching a movie. You know, like you're just like, things are just happening and they're happening perfectly. And you're just kind of, even though you're doing things, you know, you're putting down a couple rounds here and there, you're putting in your 2 cents, but man, you're just kind of like watching. And it's just like things are operating around you and going perfectly. You know, and then the other part of that, which is attached to any deployment that you always forget, especially in our position here, you know, just doing training here in Nellis, being able to see the business end of our country at the strategic level and being able to see like what that means and how cool that is. And you're like, not a lot of other nations do the things that we do. Like, I am now flying an aircraft over someone else's sovereign territory, taking care of bad guys and taking them off the face of the earth. Like, that's a unique thing. Like, there's not a fighter pilot from some other country that's also doing that. Like, that's, yeah. So it's cool to kind of see the, you know, the American military might and how that formulates and kind of serves as a basis for our national power as well. But yeah, it doesn't get any better than this lifestyle. I mean, it's really, you want to talk about a life well lived. There's obviously frustrations everywhere, but man, you take those little bit of frustrations and then you look at all the positives that you get out of it and all the relationships. Man, it doesn't get any better than that.
Well, I mean, we can go back to the combat, but I mean, just on the point that you're talking about right now, the life that kind of you've been able to live, right? You've been overseas, not just in a deployment kind of thing, but, you know, or in training, but you've lived overseas too.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. Like, so when I, you know, first got my wings and then trained in the F-16, my first assignment was in Korea. I spent almost 22 months in Korea, first assignment. Was a young single fighter pilot. It was a blast. Didn't get any better than that. Like, just being able to hunker down, focus on your craft for almost 2 years. And then moved to Japan and then spent the next 2 years in Japan prior to coming here for weapons school as a young instructor. But yeah, that, I mean, that sort of opportunity, regardless of what your career field is, being able to see other cultures. And I mean, you know, you're the same way, but when you look back and you're like, man, I spent almost 7 years out of my 20s in Asia, in another country. Like that's a significant chunk of your life, mm-hmm. that 99% of the rest of the US population is never going to experience that. Like, even if they're well-traveled and they've done things, those are trips. You didn't live.
Yeah.
Like that. So that's, it's cool. And it's, it can be a sacrifice. But, and that sort of opportunity, I think that personal and obviously professional, but mostly personal growth of just being able to see that, definitely broadens your perspective as to what life could be like. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and you see, and it's even cool when, you know, you get off base in the Middle East and, you know, you can see little facets of American life or see little facets of little pockets of goodness in every single culture. And you're like, man, that's really awesome that, you know, I spent over a year of my life in Kuwait. And the Kuwaitis have a really cool thing in their culture where they vie for and lease lots of land from their government, and they go out and set up camps and tents out in the desert off these lots of land, and they camp for about, you know, 6 months a year. And being able to see that and be a part of that, you're like, man, that's like, just how unique is that to walk into someone's tent, their camp they have set up in the middle of the desert, and spend some time. And so, I mean, those sort of thoughts and experiences just can't be beat. Can't get those anywhere else.
Yeah, no, you're right. You definitely, you pick the good and the bad out of some of the cultures. And it's funny because you get to see some of the things that are, you know, whether it's portrayed on the news or social media or stuff like that, and you're like, they've got it wrong. They're reporting on that wrong, or they are misconstruing what this is, because, hey, I live there or I experienced this, and you've got a little bit more truth data on what it actually is.
Right.
Versus, well, they're telling me that, so it must be factual, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Or just like everything else, like there's trade-offs. And so you hear about the bad, and it's not necessarily even that the news got it wrong. Like, sure, that's bad, but that was a cultural trade-off. And oh, by the way, look at what they have because of that cultural trade-off. Like, they have very low crime rate and their families stay together. Like, okay, cool. Like, you know,
it might be a good thing.
there's trade-offs everywhere, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So you said 600 something combat hours?
That's right. Yeah.
Jeez, that's a lot of time.
A lot of time in the cast wheel.
Yeah.
So, most of that was cast, maybe 200 hours of that was truly burning holes in the sky doing defensive counter air over the skies of Syria during the late stages of OIR in 2018, 2019. And that was good. So there was some good stuff there. But yeah, the close air support mission and role definitely will always have a place in my heart. You know, whether we're doing it for special ops teams or big army, you know, my first real deployment was just prior to our first withdrawal from Iraq in that 2011 timeframe. We lost the SOFA agreement. We pulled all our troops back, kind of did the fallback from Mosul all the way down, and then eventually a K crossing, which was my last sortie in Iraq. I actually have an eval that says Vice flew the last F-16 combat sortie in Iraq, and that was true for about like 9 more months, you know. but anyways, so seeing all those different experiences and you know, everyone talks about their combat time, and combat means different things, and you know, it can never be discounted. But you know, how does my combat experience, especially as an aviator of my generation, how does that compare to aerial combat from people from fighter pilots in Vietnam, fighter pilots in World War II, fighter pilots in World War I? They mean different things, but it's still unique, and it's all relative, right? And so, relative to me, that was a formative experience and something that, I mean, you've known me for a while. I'm not big on a lot of things, and kind of, you know, I'm pretty lighthearted about most stuff. combat time for anyone, I think, is that's a special thing. I think that means something. Even if those times aren't as action packed, and as you know, sometimes when things are going well, they're boring,
mm-hmm.
and there's not a lot of action over there, and that's a good thing.
Well, yeah, it's definitely not like the movies where every day you're going out. I mean, yeah, there were days that we did 4 hits a night,
yep.
which was bonk. That was just nuts, and it was draining. And there were, you know, be a week long just sitting on our asses, mission planning, until more targets came up, and then we go out and do a bunch of hits. But I mean, it's there were more sitting around and mission planning and shooting and going to the range and training partner force, stuff like that, than there are, you know, straight up firefights.
Yeah, bagging dudes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's and so that's definitely, you know, that's definitely been the name of the game for your combat aviator for the past 20 years during GWAT. But it's also unique. And once again, I've already framed it with my experience doesn't compare to, you know, even other people who were in GWAT. You know, there's just luck of the draw or different times, different experiences. So I will never try to argue that my combat time is X compared to yours, because it's all relative. And it's nothing compared to what people have experienced in the past. However, you know, there are some very unique times that you find yourself in, and you know, I think going back to that flow state, there are times when, you know, you will find that nothing but that intensity of combat, even if it's not like the most, you know, like difficult suicide mission, number one dude in the playing deck that we're trying to go after, but just knowing that it's combat and knowing that you're going to take someone's life and that people's lives are on the line, that those stakes, you know, I truly believe in that stress and performance curve.
Mm-hmm.
And those are times when, man, you optimize everything around that action and that execute. And you see it amongst everyone that you're flying with. You see it amongst everyone on the ground, that everyone starts to naturally sync up as that stress level starts to increase. And it's then time to go kinetic. And there is nothing like that first drop that you have in combat when you release live weapons off your aircraft for the first time in anger to kill someone on the ground or to blow something up. In that, you know, getting your heart rate going. I mean, that heart rate's going, even though, you know, your kind of time dilution and how long tasks take. And you look back on it and watch the tapes, you're like, oh, that was like 10 seconds. And it felt like 9 hours. And you go through and you're like, man, I've done 15 weapon systems checks and I keep doing them just to make sure that I don't screw something up. And then you're like, well, actually, you know, I did that 3 times and it took 15 seconds. But in your mind, you're like, man, this took like 9 hours.
Yeah.
And then, you know, seeing that you've got everything, and then just like everything else, the enemy gets a vote or something goes wrong. And really seeing that something that we discount, that muscle memory and that training matters. And as things get more stressful, the reason why training day in and day out is so important is because you're doing so many other things. You're monitoring so much other stuff that's going on in that combat high stress environment that I'm sure the first time you ever pulled your trigger, you weren't actively doing anything to think about it. You were just rote memory, muscle memory, mm-hmm. pulling the trigger, because that's what you had done thousands of times before. And it's the same way in jets. And it's almost ends up being towards the end, like when you're driving home at the end of the day and next thing you know, you're just in your driveway and you don't remember anything. And it's weird how that happens. And it only happens usually in combat where you're like, oh, I just dropped like 2 bombs. And I just did that out of like muscle memory and did all my checks and it was successful. Yeah. But I wasn't like actively trying to do that. My body just did it because I was just trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's,
yeah.
And I think, you know, I think those are the things, and you guys have definitely hit on cultural trends and trends through our military, through standards and training, and how, you know, that continues to ebb and flow, maybe just ebb. But I think that's where old dudes like you and me need to go in hard, that the basics matter and that muscle memory and those sets matter. And we can chalk talk all we want and white card things and say, oh, they'll get it eventually. The young guys will get it eventually. It's like, you need those reps on the range. Mm-hmm. You need those reps.
Yeah. I mean, we have the same kind of system checks, if you will. You know, like if I'm on a helicopter, I'm in a vehicle or whatever, or even just out on the range, that safety on that M4, my thumb is constantly checking it.
Right.
I mean, it is, it you know, finger's always above the trigger well, right? But my thumb.
Because that's your safety, of course.
Yeah, yeah. This is my safety. Yeah. It's always there, right? It's just making sure. And it's simple, but it's one of those things where you don't even think about it. Right. It's not like, oh, yeah, I need to make sure this thing's on safe. It's just a tap, just that tactile touch. And I know, and it's simple, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's really crazy. But I don't know. What do you think about some of that stuff?
No, I think it's valid. I mean, I remember one of the major firefights. I mean, is it about 36 hours into it? And yeah, fine. By the end of that, I was smoked, you know, but through it, that stress and that anxiety, which I think that our society has given stress, the words stress and the words anxiety, a bad
negative connotation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's a negative connotation, because I think that you can use that stress and that anxiety to help your performance. And we've felt that. Everybody who's played any kind of sports or competitive, anything like that, those, you know, butterflies in your stomach or that kind of that antsiness, that's what that is. And you can use that.
Yeah.
You can capitalize that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, especially for you, AFSPEC war, talking about, you know, fighting on the ground. It's very, that's why I think combatives are so important, because, you know, even team sports, you can go out there and get gassed playing football, running plays, but it's not until you're in that ring with someone else boxing or rolling with them when, like, you really feel those hormone releases and you feel your nervous system start to respond, fight or flight. And that you can then truly learn, you're like, okay, well, this fight is going to last longer than the next 10 seconds. So I need to figure out how to harness this and get better at releasing these hormones. So that when I'm in a 36 hour fight, like, yes, I am going to need to modulate, mm-hmm. you know, my hormones and modulate my anxiety and stress levels as we go through this. And that's the other interesting thing, is that, you know, that's why mission planning and understanding what the factors are, so that you can hopefully prep yourself to know, like, dude, this is going to be a 36 hour fight, or this could develop into a 36. I hope it's a 5 minute fight, but yeah, it could be a 36 hour fight. So I got to keep some gas in the tank. And how do I account for that? And what does that
look
like?
And recognizing that was at the same time where I recognized training scar tissue, right? Because we have gone for that. You know, up until then, every time we're back in the States, every time we're on Nellis or going to CAS ranges, each one of our sorties would be, you know, depending on what platform we were working for, would be 45 minutes or an hour and a half.
Hmm.
And then there were no follow on. It's like, okay, here's the mission. And then, all right, they're checking off, weapons safe. See you later. We'll call you for a debrief.
Yeah.
When we, yeah, exactly. And now, okay, cool. I can calm down. I can chill out. But then when it's, okay, hog one and two are checking in, you know, and then it's, okay, now I've got Harriers, now I've got F-18s, now I've got Vipers. You're like, okay, cool. And we're still going, you know?
Yeah. Like when you realize that your standard, you know, just like everyone when they deploy, you know, your 12-hour duty day, when you realize that your 12-hour duty day is actually doing your active mission.
Yeah.
Like it's like when you're out on a team, your 12-hour duty day, like, you're not picking up like a shift at the DFAC.
Right.
You're doing anything afterwards. Like all 12 of those hours are going to be on the fucking mic.
Yeah. So. But you guys are in the same boat in terms of, okay, yeah, you're at least limited on munitions, right?
Yeah.
But you will you know, be in the fight, air refuel, go back to the fight. If you are at a point where, you know, your Winchester ammunitions, maybe you'll fly back to whatever, if it's close enough, you'll fly back, rearm, refuel, and press on back. So, I mean, a normal, you know, sortie for you guys could be anything but normal, and it could be very long.
Yeah. Yeah. We had one over the skies in Syria, one of my wingmen. So we were just doing a, you know, terrain denial, which is a cool way to boost your stats and drop bombs. But, you know, for everyone who's not tracking, terrain denial is to drop a bomb into the terrain to deny it to the enemy, allegedly. But anyway, so super fun. So my wingman goes to drop. He's going to drop a GBU-39. He's going to ripple off, I think, like two or three. And he goes to drop two GBU-39s. One goes off. They're pretty smooth off the rail. It was at night, so you can't really tell like what releases, what doesn't. And the things fly for, you know, a couple minutes because those things can go far. So they fly for a couple minutes. And then finally, JTAC's like, yeah, we got one spot or we got two spots. Obviously, we were looking for three. You know, because you always hear good effects after, and we didn't hear good effects. So that kind of hurt. So we do a little investigation and come to find that one of them didn't drop. Well, it's still dark. So I was like, okay, cool. Let's, you don't need us right now. Okay, cool. Let's go get some gas. So we go get some gas. The sun starts coming up. And as my wingman's on the wing of the tanker, I come off the boom. I just topped off with gas and look over, and he's got a GB-39 with its wings extended, still attached to his aircraft. So the thing got the impulse to fire. It is still just hanging on the wings there. Yeah. So you're like, okay, maybe we're not going to go get gas just yet until we get rid of that. We are at about the 5-hour mark, and probably we're going to fly maybe, I would say on average, like a 7 to 8 hour sortie was standard. So we're getting towards the end of our sortie already. Well, and then now we're trying to figure out, and this was, you know, once again, this is part of my combat experience and all of my comrades' combat experience over the 20 years is, you know, and I won't say it actually can be harder in some, you know, you brief like, oh, it's combat. You got a problem with your weapons. I'm just going to jettison them.
It's not that easy.
That's right. And, you know, same things for you guys that like dudes on the ground in World War II. Like, you can't execute that crap. You can't just leave a weapon somewhere. Because guess what? Like, you're in bad guy land right now. And that weapon becomes someone else's weapon just because you couldn't get it to work for 5 minutes. So the same thing. If I go and jettison a GBU-39 over Syria, that becomes the next IED that's going to go blow you and your boys up. So we got to figure out where to put this thing. So we find a place that we're going to put it. It's going to be in Syria. But close to a FOB where friendlies and EOD team can go out there and retrieve it. But then now you've got a U.S. EOD team that's going outside the gate to go decommission your live warhead that you dropped. And so then now, even though you want to be back at the DFAC and go hit the gym, because, of course, I got to work on this yoke.
Yeah, of course.
Standard. I mean, yeah. You realize that you can't do that because you're going to leave those dudes. And there's as much as we'd like to think, like the KOC or the Air Force is going to retask. They're not going to task someone to go do that. So then now you're like, okay, well, we're going to stay here and do this. And this is where, and I'm sure you've seen it. The Air Force is great about putting chess pieces. The military is great about putting chess pieces on the map for how support and how to mitigate risk. And we're good at that initial placement, but when shit hits the fan, that kind of managing those things, it comes down to dudes like you. Mm-hmm. And that's where leadership comes in. And it took my first combat deployment to realize, you're like, man, is someone going to go help these dudes out? Guess who that someone is? It's me. Yeah. So anyways, getting back to it. So, okay, so we're going to support these dudes. Well, it turns out it takes, you know, an hour for them to kit up, about 2 hours to travel out there. The guy finally, you know, so we try to find the impact, which is really hard when you drop a, you know, tiny little warhead in the middle of the desert. But we find it eventually. But what we didn't find was the rest of the rack had fallen maybe 500 meters short. So these dudes drive out in a bongo truck or whatever your standard, like Toyota Hilux. And they get out there and he ends up putting it in park, like directly over top of like half of the munitions that we jettison. And then he hops out and he's like, yep, I got to move back about 500 meters, pretty close to this thing. So now he's got to walk almost a mile in his like standard, whatever the suit. Jeremy Renner yeah. suit. Yeah.
Jeremy
like,
Renner yeah. suit. Perfect.
Fucking Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
So anyways, so he gets out there, they death them, take care of the ordnance and get back in. But by the time all was said and done, it was a 12 plus hour sortie when we come back and land. And the thing that was a limiting factor in the F-16 wasn't gas. We could keep refueling forever. It wasn't even like human capability because we got go pills. And so I'm hopped up out of my mind, especially, right. you know, not to mention all the rip-its. But there's actually physical space in the cockpit for your piss bags. Just not enough space because you are stacked up. And I'll never forget taxiing back in from that mission.
Here's one.
The crew chief crawls up the ladder and is like, hey, Vice, what's going on, man? How was the combat mission? You drop any bombs? You kill any bad dudes? And I'm just like, can you help me out with all these piss bags? Like you guys got some trash bags? Like, because I had like 30 piss bags because you're out there for
all those rippers.
That's right. That's all those damn rippers. Yeah. And drugs. But yeah. So it's good.
Yeah, I don't think people realize how small it is in that Viper. So, I mean, you're a pretty tall dude.
Yeah, and he and like stacked
and obviously jacked.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the max.
Yep.
And I'm a small guy and I get in that thing and I feel claustrophobic. Not claustrophobic, but I feel like, wow, there ain't much to this.
Dude, there is, you can not really do that with your elbows.
No.
You touch things. It's cozy though. It's like a mummy sleeping bag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one's ever going to say that a mummy sleeping bag is like spacious, but once you get in there, it's cozy.
It's nice.
Yeah, it's cozy. So definitely different than the F-35. F-35 is a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
So it's nicer in that regard. But yeah, I mean, that F-16 is a tight cockpit. And that was designed to fly, you know, sorties, you know, at a time when we were in the Cold War. Versus Soviet Union, fly out of a base in Europe, do a quick strike, go back, land, refuel, and do all that. So we're talking, yeah. you know, 2-hour missions, maybe one air refueling, maybe a 4-hour mission. And then during GWAT, you know, it became a pretty good workhorse for our nation to do close air support. And we started cranking it up and doing, you know, 8-hour mission. I'll never forget still being a young wingman in the F-16. And this was, you know, post shock and awe 2003 kicking down the door, and we started like really doing picking up CAS as a primary mission or NTISR as well. And that's when I'll never forget, dudes were like, oh, they flew like a 6-hour mission, and here we are like after Libya, dudes were doing 12-hour missions during Libya. I mean, it's weird how that's changed in our psyche of fighter aviation. Been all good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to take a step back a little bit because, and we've talked about this before, but you have you kind of came to an interesting revelation about training and reps. Whenever you talked about playing a whole bunch of Halo, it's your Halo story, right?
Yeah.
Playing a bunch of Halo, and I don't want to tell it because you tell it better, but.
Do I?
I don't know. Okay. Maybe you do. Maybe
I think
you
told my story. But. Yeah. So, I mean, that's good. It goes back to reps and sets, and it's, you know, especially germane in the, a lot of it ties to where I think we need to go in the future with synthetic training. And the thought out there is that it's old dudes, and maybe it is, maybe it has been in the past, old dudes like you and me are, you know, we push back on like new age training and don't value that. And I think that can be true, but to an extent, but there's some really specific value. And I know you've seen it in your community. And, you know, we see it in like JTAC simulators, but the synthetic environment, it's what I think we all push back for is that it can be a direct comparison for that real life experience. Yeah, it can't be. Not. So let's stop trying to have that argument. So we always have the wrong arguments, right? So let's not have that argument. Really, the talk is, is synthetic and is it valuable in some areas and what can we do with it? And for me, my revelation was, as a young flight lead in Kunsan. So I'm a flight lead. You know, I've upgraded. I'm doing well. Actually identified as someone who's, you know, doing really well as a young F-16 flight lead. And you know, maybe had some drinks. It's Kunsan. Who knows? Anyway, so I mean, this is early 2000s. So Halo is hot. Might even been Halo 2. Anyway, so we're playing Halo. Me and a bunch of dudes. But I'll tell you what, it was so old. Like, we didn't even have Wi-Fi back then. It was
a LAN party.
We had no shit. Like, dudes were running cables through ceiling tiles to hook up to your local LAN. But anyway, so we're playing Halo, and meet a bunch of other fighter pilots. And one of my good buddies, you know, he's talking shit like he always does. Well, as he's talking shit from down the hallway, I can hear him. I go and like jump off of like this really tall, high like structure, land, and immediately like no scope sniper rifle from like 350 simulated yards right through the dude's head and just fucking drop him like hard, win the game for the team. And like in that exact moment, the thing that struck me at that point of not only just being fantastic and awesome at Halo, being an awesome fighter pilot who's recognized as someone talented, the thing that struck me at that moment was, why am I better at Halo than I am at my own primary mission weapon system? And it all goes back to how we train. And that right there, I was like, not going to have it. So the F-16 has, you know, and all platforms have differing levels of simulators, you know, ones that are just kind of like Falcon 4.0, Thrustmaster controls, Microsoft Flight Simulator, to then like, okay, it's, you know, it's definitely an F-16. It's been approved by the lead contractor in the F-16 case, Lockheed. It's certified that it's realistic like an F-16, but maybe it doesn't have all the displays. It just has just a TV screen. And then you have, you know, your full 360 dome.
That are moving.
Linked together with other platforms. And so you can all simulate a fight. Well, every F-16 unit has just your basic base level trainer that they keep in their vault, but no one uses it. No one uses it. So me, for the next 5 years of my life, even as a weapons officer with this patch, I would sit back there. And if I was bored, done doing like my whatever queep tasking I had, I'd get that stuff out of the way and I'd go hop in the simulator. And I'm just in there just doing like basic bomb dropping, basic missile shooting, just those kind of reps and sets, and just doing that over and over again. So it was just muscle memory. You would think that we do that in fighter aviation. And to this day, we do not do that in the way that we train. The same way that like I would expect someone to be a champion or elite at any sport or musical instrument or mathematics, those reps and sets, we do not impart that into the way that we train our basic people. It's almost like it's seen as beneath. And it's like, oh, you know, especially once you start to build some of those credentials as a flight lead and instructor pilot, doing that is almost going backwards, because the built-in assumption is that you know how to do that stuff and you can do it. And I would challenge that we can all be better. And just because you might be the best person on the base doesn't mean you can't be better yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's in that in particular, something with a synthetic environment, something that I can't, you know, it would take 20 plus years of doing nothing but flying a fighter and doing a very basic mission set, millions and millions of dollars to be able to get that experience, or I can go hop in a sim and get that for free over the course of a year.
Right. The cost difference is enormous. Yeah, and you can just go rep, reset, and just keep doing that.
Yeah. And then the bigger thing, and when we talk about future and advanced technology with AI, is I want AI to be able to teach Peaches how to be the best, based on what it knows you need. Not just I show up and I do the standard pipeline training, like, you know, here's the given scenario that we give every single student. Here's what trips up every single F-16 pilot. So we'll give them that scenario and hit play. Like, maybe I do that first, and maybe I have to do that every once in a while. But like when I log in, the system knows, you know, when I'm scheduled to go fly for that hour in that simulator, the simulator's like, oh, this is Vice again. Oh, Vice sucks at this. So I'm going to, this is all I'm going to do for him. Yeah. Like, oh, Vice will never get this one. And that's the level of training that we need. Like, everything should be tailored. Mm-hmm. I think the days of, you know, it's funny that, and I think as we continue, you know, as our all volunteer force continues to morph and change and become more advanced in super way in ways with next generation warfare, our training needs to evolve out in many ways. Our training and the training that you and I definitely experienced is not that much different than now. We've gotten better because of the global war on terror. And that's part of the goodness of real operational, but like our training pipeline wasn't that much different than 1950s/Vietnam era stuff. Yeah. You know, kind of like, let's just do it for the masses. You know, you have to achieve this level of performance at this skill, and then you can do this skill. But it's not about optimizing. And I think we're beyond that. And there's so little, I think the margins are so small, whether we're talking our own budget and in money and fiscal issues, or whether we're talking the enemy's capabilities. The margins are just small. And so I need everything optimized. Yeah. I can no, like, you know, almost the entire force needs to be optimized the same way that AFSOC has been optimizing through the 20 plus years of GWAT. And I think we just all need to do that across the force. There's nothing that we can do and just say, oh, well, like over the course of time, we'll get it. And we're the world's hegemon and our forces and our technology is so advanced that we'll be fine. Like, we'll figure it out. Like, no, we need to be optimized now, and there's no wasted space. And even if training is good, if it's not optimized, I think it's a waste.
Well, yeah, it's tough to scale training to meet everybody's needs. And I think that's why you have your things like Red Flag. You have your things like Green Flag, Black Flag, Bamboo Eagle, Weapon School integration. Why the Weapon School, part of the reason why the Weapon School exists, right? Because we can't give everybody the same level of training. We can't, because you need something different than what I need. You just can't, you know, peanut butter spread training.
Right. Or, you know, I think here at Weapon School, and certainly through your pipeline, there's also an interesting, we talk about the bar, right? Like meeting the bar. And that's a pretty universally accepted term. It's hard to define. No one knows what that is. We always say, you know, here for putting a patch on your shoulder, like you've met the bar. And once you've met the bar, guess what? You've met the bar and you never need to demonstrate anything again. Which isn't always true in that it's seen as like, okay, cool, you're never going to get better or you're never going to have any more training opportunities. There's always there. And especially if you're personally and internally driven, like most of our individuals are, people are going to continue to get better. But it's that we don't have a system in place to necessarily continue to iterate on that. And I think that's also a blind spot in our communities here at the Weapon School, is that once you put a patch on your shoulder, it's like, oh, you've met the bar. Like, you're it. Now it's time to go make everyone else better. That's true. But can we also talk about how we can make this person better as well? And I think that's where I think that tailored instruction, hopefully facilitated by future advanced tech, can really help to kind of fill in some of those gaps. But we need to all get better.
Yes, yes, we do. We've got to get better, and we can't rest on, okay, yeah, it's great. Sure, we've met the bar, you know, since we're using the Weapon School analogy. Yeah, we've met the bar. We've got a patch, but that doesn't mean that you stop.
Right.
You've got to continue to get better. And I think that's one of the things that I know that you're wanting to kind of explore in the way that, okay, yeah, the Weapon School right now makes patches, right? We have instructor cadre that are, you know, the best at their platform or their mission set or whatever they do. They get students in every 6 months and they instruct. And they, you know, get them to the point where they improve and they meet that bar and they go on. But I think recognizing that we have to improve the instructors as well, I think that's something that I know that you're trying to explore.
Yep.
or not trying to, but you are exploring on how do we continue to develop? How do we continue to not just look at it, but definitely improve the instructors?
Right. And there's a huge human performance piece in that, right? And that's a lot of it is human performance. There's also just the regular training in that we've developed these training models that once again are, you know, 50, multiple decades old, and these paradigms for training. And we're at the end of them. Like here at the weapons school, we are at the end of that training model. Now, granted, there's other trainings to, you know, for command and leadership and in other experiences. So I'm not saying that this is the end of Air Force training at like the major level. But in your platform and tactical level, it's about the pinnacle. And so there's other experiences that you can continue to get better. But there's nothing deliberate beyond that. And I think we need to just stay, there should be a model which is perfect. And I think eventually, unfortunately, if we don't start moving towards there as humans, we will soon be rendered insufficient and someone else will take that model over for us. And so I would just assume that we start down that path, not to necessarily stave off any sort of future technology, because that'll all be good and take care of itself. Humans are always going to be a part of warfare. The nature of warfare ain't going to change. The character of war can change, and it certainly has already and will continue to morph. But the nature is going to be the same. It's going to be a human endeavor, and you're going to need humans involved in that. You're going to need humans on the ground, especially. So I think I think we need to relook at the model that, like, once you get to this level, you're done and you're good. Like, we need, there needs to be active training models to do. Okay, you showed up at your team and there's qualifications and making sure you're certified. And there's things like, okay, you haven't done this in a while. Let's get you respun up. But the assumption is still that you're a full up round. And I think we should get away from that full up round bar mentality. And like, the scale is infinity. I'm trying to just continue to make you better. That's right. So, and that never stops. You're a colonel. Every time I go out there and fly in a jet, you'd be amazed how low the expectations are for me. You'd be amazed. I'm fantastic. And I go out there and just beat up on all the young guys, but they don't expect me to. There should be expectations for me.
Yeah.
Like I should, like there should be training programs. And so, you know, if you think I'm as bad as they all think I am, there should still be a very deliberate program to get me back up to speed. Right. But that doesn't exist, to be honest. And some of that's by design. Like no one needs vice and peaches. Although I think,
I would argue that I think maybe they do.
They literally asked for you. So a couple weeks ago. Yeah. So yeah. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting where, you know, a lot of that probably just goes to the way the military is designed about youth, right? Because you and I are the old guys and we're 42. Like,
that's not really old.
That's not even close to being old.
Right.
But we treat it like that in the military because everyone else is 18. So, and that's fine. But I think we can go further, especially in some specialties and career fields where like we owe it for our people to continue like a lifelong journey to infinity of improvement.
So. Yeah. And I think that improvement is not focused around, you know, your standard professional military education. I don't think that that's what we're talking about.
No.
Sure, you have those blocks, and I'm not hating on PME, right? But there's a time and place for that, and there's a time and place for the kind of training, education, and improvement that we're talking about.
Yeah, like let's even say like your weapons qualifications, right? I'll try to frame it in there. We'll see if it's useful. It might not be, but like you got there now, and dude, I know you're still balling, so you'd be able to put mad metal down target. Right. You'd be great, right? And you'd be able to qualify, and you meet all the requirements. And even if you were better than qualification, you're like, geez, and like all the young guys on the range are like, wow, Peter's still old man, still got it, right? There, if you had the right technology to analyze things that you're doing, there's always something that you could have been doing better. And like, yes, okay, you maximize that, but you were way too slow in between trigger pulls, or you know, yeah, you met the parameters of the course and like you won the scenario, but there were things that you were deficient at. And we could come back and look at that. And we currently don't get to that. Like we're never able to neck down to that level of precision. I think we'll have to, and I think we need that nowadays. It's just thinking of other ways and breaking down assumptions that we have. Assumptions for me in this organization is when you put that patch on your shoulder, you're the best. And so obviously we do a lot for, you know, to reinforce being humble and approachability and credibility. But still the underlying assumption is that that person has reached the bar and that they know what's up. I would like to flip that on its head and say, yes, that's true. But for that individual, they're still on a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when you do that, you know, I think it'll continue to push the ball forward.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're on a journey of service, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, that's kind of where why we're all here, and maybe not all of us, but that's why a lot of us are here and continue to is for that service.
Yeah. Service is, you know, you and I definitely chat about this all the time. I see service as the thing that's missing from our discussions on either retention, or it's missing from our discussions on recruiting. I think at the end of the day, there are a lot of things practically that the service needs to aspire to and do better on for our people, based on cultural changes, based on deficiencies, future force structure. There's things that need to change. And those are great. Those should continue. But when you're looking at it from a retention lens, there's nothing practical that I can ever offer you or say to you, or you can ever realize, that will probably ever get you to lean towards, yeah, I should probably stay in. I think it, at the end of the day, becomes an emotional decision. And that emotional decision is tied to a couple of things, and it's all founded upon service. And I think the same reasons why you chose to do something unique and serve your country and be part of something bigger than yourself, those are the same reasons that'll keep you in, and the same reason that have kept you in thus far. And that's what we need to continue to message and tap into and make people just realize that those are the things that are special. Because right now we have it at a very, especially from a rated retention standpoint, we're at a very transactional level of, oh, well, you know, if I could just get you to this base, then maybe you could stay in because of such and such, like you got family there. Or if, you know, I could just keep you here for one more year and then you can go to this specific school, then you'll stay in for 20 years. Sure, we should try to do some of those things. We should try our best to get you there. But what's missing from that conversation is service. And that's the thing that I can always guarantee you, like you're going to serve. And I think there's something really special to that. And a lot of these times, you know, I've seen it in people's eyes that when I say, dude, what would I copy what you're asking me, you know, you're asking me for some sort of assignment, and that's fine. We can work on that. But you're also thinking about getting out of the military and getting out of flying fighter jets every single day. What would you, as a brand spanking new first lieutenant fighter pilot, what would you tell yourself right now? How would you see that? And I think at some point through this career, we kind of lose the forest for the trees. And I think we could do a better job as a service and better job specifically as leaders to reinforce why we're doing things and why it's important and how special it is and unique it is. Because all it takes is for dudes like you and me who are on the other side of 20 to know, actually, like, time is short. Time is not long. Like, dude, time is short. Time is short on this earth, but time is short in this military. And this is awesome. And this is good. And man, I got to harness this. And when I see people jumping over the side and they're never going to get that experience, it breaks my heart. Like, absolutely breaks my heart. Because I think they're tied very much into, because of our messaging, a very transactional, practical discussion on how I can fit my life into service and fit my life into the Air Force. No, That's the wrong way to look at it. You need to have red lines in your life. Like, okay, my wife just started a brand new career and she cannot move. That's a red line. Got it. Or I'm not moving my kids again because they're about to start their junior year in high school and they've already been to 3 high schools. Got it. That is a red line for you. But let's work to give the service as much space as you can around those red lines. So let's refine those and let's not induce red lines where they're not really red lines. It might be a deficiency and it might not be ideal, but mm-hmm. let's not make a red line where there isn't a red line. And let's realize at the end of the day, like we're all here to serve so that you can stay on the team and get those experiences. Because I've seen it in people's faces. I've seen it in friends' faces that there's a missed opportunity there. And they went on to do great things and they're fantastic. They're happy and they're taking care of their family and that's great. But if they would have had the experience of taking a fighter squadron downrange, go to combat, bring them all back home safe, I think they would want that, you know, in the tank when they're 80 years old.
Yeah, I mean it's an interesting thing when you're talking about servitude and service of others, right? And then you can say it's a service of your nation, service of the Air Force, but really, you know, depending if it's a fighter squadron or a special tactics squadron or something like that, you're in service of those at that human level, and then taking them downrange or taking them on training trips or whatever it is. It's that human connection that I think is what it's all about.
Yeah. And, you know, especially as instructors, as weapons officers, I think service is at the heart of everything we do. Like nothing other than service forces you to run a program for someone that is only geared to make them the best person they can be. And then you're going to literally spend time, massive amounts of time away from your family, away from other stuff that's going on in your life, just to make that one person better. Like, so all of our instructors here at the weapons school, mm-hmm. they are serving every single day and they're serving something. They're serving a higher good for this Air Force to make it a better place and to make the individuals better. Like that service. And the beauty of it is, and that's why it breaks my heart even more when those people choose to leave for a myriad of reasons. And so we don't have to get into all that. But like, that's exactly what they're going to do for the rest of their career. And they're geared to it. And they're the best at it. At serving. So that's why it's so important. And that's why it's such a hit to our Air Force beyond just being difficult for me, but it's a real loss of capability to our Air Force. Cause those are the same person that's going to spend 15 hours debriefing to make you better is the person that I want taking care of our young airmen off mm-hmm. the street. Right. Cause they've got the right side picture. They know what's important. They know how to take care of people. And so, it all comes down to service. It really does.
Yep.
Yeah.
Let me check what time we're at here. So we're at like 58 minutes. So so we'll close it up. What we'll do though is kind of end how we always kind of end. And we definitely got to have you on again because, I mean, I got a list up there of things that we could have talked about and we didn't really hit much of that. So yeah. And it's not like it's that difficult for me to just pull you in here anyway. So,
get some sound. Any sound bites for any shorts?
Yeah. Well, one of them is going to be because I'm going to ask you about advice. So, what would you give? And you could hit any, you know, category or person you want. You could be, you know, the young person that's looking to enlist, the young person that's looking to go to ROTC at yeah. college or the academy or be a pilot or be whatever, whatever category of person or all the above that you want to hit. But what is some kind of advice that you would want to give them to set them on a right path?
All right. You ready for that now?
Go for it.
So I don't think it's that. I don't think it's that dissimilar than what we were talking about with service. So my advice for any young person considering a path through the military, either directly out of high school, or they're in college, maybe thinking about ROTC, might be fun, you know, at least it's a solid job. What I would tell them is to believe, hit the I believe button. There is so much in our culture, in our national, you know, discussion these days that disillusions people, gets people to think that something might be bad, might not be good for them, or at the same time, gets them to think very practically and think like, ooh, you must do this, then that, to have a happy life. What I'll tell you is that I think a key part of a happy life is feeling like you've done something of consequence and led a life well lived. I'll tell you what, the military is a great starting point for that, for you to decide. And so I would just say, hit the I believe button. Wouldn't listen to press clippings. I'd talk to people that served and let that inform you. But what I would also say is, if you got that little feeling in the back of your head, like, man, I kind of just want to do something different. I want to do something special. I want to be part of a team. I want to be part of something bigger than myself. I love my country. I want to serve my country. You know, I think my country's still worth fighting for. If any of those things resonate even a little bit, say hit the I believe button and go for it. Because I'll tell you what, I mean, just like everything else, if you don't sign up for it, you're never going to know. Yeah. So it's the best opportunity.
The I believe button is for sure a thing. It's even if you only do 4 years,
right?
You're still served your country. You still served, you know. And the good chance, yeah, there are folks that will bounce after 4 years, and that's fine.
That's perfect.
I don't want to say nobody begrudges them for that, because there are for sure are people that are like, oh,
what are you doing?
Yeah, you're getting out, you know, that kind of stuff. I've never been that person, but you do 4 years, you do 6 years, it's only 4 or 6 years of your life. And if it sets you in a trajectory that you are better at the end of that term, 4 years, 6 years, whatever it is, if you are better off then than you were when you first joined, then it's a net win. It's a gain.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. You know, I see so many people, you know, who are lost or maybe had a tough time in high school, don't know exactly what they want to do, like completely slingshot and start their life off right and start their adult life off on the right foot and really understand, you know, and helps them really refine what they want out of life and what their goals are, who end up not staying in the military. Mm-hmm. But man, they are off to the races. Yep. Whereas I'm not sure whatever, you know, especially in our modern culture, I don't think there are too many other safety nets like that out there. Like, there's just too much stuff on the periphery that can pull those people who are kind of undecideds, can pull them in the wrong direction, and then subsequently just tank the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
The military is still a fantastic tool to kind of safety net, grab those people in, give them a little purpose, allow you to serve your country and serve a higher calling, and then set you off and let you do whatever you want to do with the rest of your life.
Yep.
Like, and still be part of the 1% club who serve your nation. I mean, what gets better than that?
No, I'm with you.
It's really good. And it's unfortunate that we have, you know, a lot of negative connotations that we see circulating through our national discourse about serving, and there's thoughts and things that go through people's mind on, you know, how service may be bad for you or may, you know, you'll end up being worse off at the end of it. Certainly at the end of the day, you're serving your country and you're signing up to serve your country in very tough conditions, and ultimately give your life and sacrifice. And that could happen. And you should be prepared for that to happen, but that doesn't mean it will happen. It doesn't happen to the majority. You know, I think just like everything else in life, we are so much, the good column is so much more full than the bad column that for you and me, it's like, it's like a no brainer.
Exactly.
It's almost like I haven't even given it a thought. But yeah, no, just gotta believe and go, because I'll tell you what, I wouldn't have wanted to live these past 20 plus years, plus another 4 years of the academy. I wouldn't want to have done anything else. So yeah. People I've met, experiences I've gotten, the opportunity to serve my country, like it's something now that, you know, as an older dude with a wife and kids, that now they've become a part of that as well. And they've gotten to serve. And it's affected them, sometimes bad, but mostly good, to the extent of which, like, it's part of their identity. It's part of who they are, and they love it. And so that's such a unique opportunity that you can't describe to anyone else who hasn't served. And so for any young folks out there, just go for it. Just go for it.
Yep.
You'll never know for sure, but just go for it. Trust me.
But if, no, you will never know for sure, but that what if will always be in the back of your mind.
Yep.
And then you'll miss your window to go in.
That's right.
And then it'll live with you for forever.
That's right. I mean, no matter where you go in society, day in, day out, you always meet that person that's like, oh, I almost joined up. I almost did this. And you're like, well, instead you're doing that now.
Yeah.
The people that actually served, they're doing like fantastic things in this world. So
I agree.
Tells you something.
Well, Vice.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks for having,
absolutely,
not having me, but thanks for, well, actually, yeah. Thanks for having me at the web school. How about that? thanks for coming on. All right. We're out here. Later.
Get back to work, peeps.